Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
I do remember 2013, and it's when Sebastian from Udacity, the founder, which is really a genius, he said during a conference that in 50 years, now 40 years, there would be only 10 universities in the world. And that was a really wide guess, right? And I really do remember reading this and saying, hey, yeah, I don't agree, but...
During the past decade, numerous startups like bootcamps and MOOCs have tried to disrupt and remain the higher education system. However, the idea of merging these modern educational models with traditional universities seemed far-fetched until recently. In 2022, Alura, an edtech startup from Brazil, made headlines by acquiring FIAP, a well-known private technology university in the country. This move was a strategic step towards offering comprehensive courses and in-person classes complementing their online programs. With over 120,000 paid subscribers, Alura has emerged as the largest online education startup in Latin America. Today, I sat with Paulo Silveira, Alura's founder, to understand the reasoning behind acquiring a traditional university.
People think I'm crazy since we acquired a real university, right? It's one step further, right?
Why online education can grow as fast as a software.
Oh, AI is one example, right? You can do a lot of things generating with AI. Maybe this can help growth in the short term, but will this be really good for the students?
And whether startups will actually be able to disrupt traditional universities.
I don't think this is a game changer when people say totally automatic doing content.
Paulo has a unique perspective on the future of education, so I hope that you enjoy our conversation.
Paulo, welcome to the show.
Hi, Enzo. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me. It's really good to be here and talk to you again.
No, awesome. I appreciate the time. And I think there's a lot of interesting topics that we can dive into, given your extensive background. I think Alura has a great story that is not very well known out of Brazil. And most people should know about what you guys have built over there because it's very impressive. And I love to start by talking about the context in which Alura operates, which is obviously the Brazilian market. I mean, when you start studying, the market has some of the, probably one of the largest private university markets in the world.
That's true.
Including five companies, which are public companies, some actually even in the US, some locally in the Brazilian stock market. And these companies generate billions of dollars of revenue in a world where I think education is shifting increasingly towards online. I feel like Alura sits in a very strategic or interesting position, given that you guys were born online, not like these universities, which obviously had to change from offline to online. So in this context, I wonder, like, what is interesting in your eyes about the higher education system in Brazil and the role that Alura can play in it?
That's a nice question, right, Enzo? Usually people who look at me, and I have got all this kind of VC and private equity rounds, they ask me, so why have you gone to this direction? Because we were fully online, unregulated market, which is much easier. You can move very fast. You can take different decisions, test a lot of different things without anyone pointing to you and saying, hey, look, you can do this, you should do that, you should take care, you should operate this way or that way, right? The private market or even the higher ed, what I mean here when someone asks me why the higher ed is that as far as I see, there will always be space for the higher ed and really deep learning and specialization, right? Because nowadays we are trying to move fast with careers. We have realized not only because of the crisis on the VC and tech market, but we were already realizing that for most professional skills, even only hard skills, you need to study and practice a lot. You can have a really decent, good job with only 3 months, 6 months learning. For sure, there are a lot of exceptions, but if you go to a company and any of the big techs that are already trying to say to you, hey, you don't need a diploma, you don't need a degree to work here with us. If you go there and you ask, who here have diplomas and degrees and grads, undergrads, you will see that 95% of them will have, and most of them will be from top universities from the US and all around the world. So what is interesting to me is that it was always a dream for me to be a professor. So when I founded the company with my brother, we were looking to be researchers, PhDs, and having a career as a professor. And now we can meet our dreams here. And at the same time, we see and we do put a lot of value in this kind of study path. Instead of only studying what the market needs, you really need the basics. You really need a lot of depth in the basics. Otherwise, we will be just copy-pasting coding and Stack Overflow and ChatGPT and so on. And when you have your first big error, first big challenge, you can't move along. So the university market is really special for us because we do really believe that this is not something that is going away really fast because of online learning or edtechs or startups. It's like hospitals, it's like libraries. It will take really a while things change. So there is a red ocean opportunity if you can move in this direction.
That's a very contrarian view, I think, on what most edtechs or education technology companies
I do agree
have done. And I wonder, because you were describing all the challenges or extra costs and effort you guys have to carry when going into the regulated market. So tell us a bit more about what was the rationale behind acquiring a university and getting into that game. Something that I wonder is, was it indispensable to actually reach this second phase of Alura's growth? Because that's something that I always think about. We've been sort of sold this huge story that all education will go online, universities will be disrupted. And that has sort of proven not to be true.
In a way,
despite so much money going in, what I had less, my impression is that you guys understood that earlier and said, okay, if we actually want to grow and build a big company, a big business and serve much more students, we have to go into that market.
Yeah, so that's also a good question. 10 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago, we had all these kind of massive online courses going on, right?
Mm-hmm. The MOOCs, Coursera.
Udacity starting and getting traction, a lot of traction and attention, edX and so on. I do remember 2013, I also leave a link here, which is pretty interesting. It's from a blog called Hack Education. It's very sharp. It's always trying to push hard and try to criticize the edtechs. The link here is from 2013, and it's when Sebastian from Udacity, the founder, which is really a genius, he said during a conference that in 50 years, now 40 years, there would be only 10 universities in the world. And that was a really wide guess, right? And I really do remember reading this and saying, hey, yeah, I don't agree, but who knows? And who am I here to say something against Sebastian, right? So this post here goes really sharp, telling us all about bundling and unbundling. So there is this kind of, you know better than myself, right? This startup thing that you can create a startup either bundling, either unbundling stuff from a competitor or from a different market. So the edtechs tried to unbundle everything. So they tried to unbundle LMS, LXPs, grades, gamifications, contents, OPMs, support, professors, everything you can, virtual reality experience, everything that you can imagine. Here in Brazil, we do call it platformization, which is always is also a situation that we have here at Alura, and you can see in our benchmarks in the US and Europe as Pluralsight, Udacity, maybe Udemy, which is a marketplace, it's a little bit different. So it didn't work. It didn't work. So a school, a university, a place where you do learn, you are looking for a social space where you can connect with different students, professors, and really being about like a think tank authority. You know, if I say to you, Enzo, I'm launching a university today, would you rather study in my university or in a 50 years old university, real campus? So the authority and delivering results, outcomes to the students is really what is about a university or even a school, even an online school. Acquiring a university, a prestigious one, a top tier one here in Brazil, which is FIAP, was really our plan A. We also had the plan B, which was creating our own, and that would take years to take off. Acquiring one, and there are only a few, to be honest, just one that are only tech focused here in São Paulo, was mandatory for us. Because about reputation, community, and authority, you can't create this only with money. You can't blitzscale something like this, you know?
So that it was more about the brand rather than the, say, the certification or that the regulation that allow you to play in that market.
Yeah, the regulation is also something really complicated here in Brazil and in Latin America too. In the US, it's even more, in Europe, it's even more complex. But it was more about the community authority and the history about the university that is solid, that has already alumni that have really good positions in tech market in Brazil. With this, we can leverage. So the plan is to leverage FIAP all around Brazil and in the online sector, which we are doing, creating co-branded products and delivering their products to our audience. So we can get the synergy here. Yeah.
So I would love to go to the back to the moment in which you start thinking about this decision.
Okay.
I mean, you don't decide to acquire a university in a few months. It was probably a couple of years process in which you were thinking about this possibility. So I would love for you to take us back to that moment in which you, I mean, there was some challenges or some limitations that you were facing within the Alura business that forced you to start thinking about this possibility. What was that process like?
There is also some kind of vision from myself here. So I really think the education space, also the health space, they are really hard for startups because you need a lot of time to prove your value. You can cure a patient much, much 10 times faster, 100 times faster than the different hospital. You can't teach a student 100 times fast. This is bullshit. You really can't disrupt learning. Maybe you can disrupt teaching, but the learning, Enzo still needs to sit down, study, practice, and put a lot of time and effort. Otherwise, you won't be getting any outcomes.
Until Elon Musk launches the Neuralink and installs.
Otherwise, there is no cheating here. I think really funny. So there are always a couple of guys in Silicon Valley thinking that they can disrupt 100 years of effort among people that are studying learning sciences in top-notch universities. They can't. They've never taught anything to anyone. You can't do this. You know, it's like curing a disease. All disease, not only a disease, all disease much faster than anyone. It's simply a task that doesn't make any sense. So there is a constant improvement. Doing anything that you can improve teaching and learning, it's already a benchmark. It's really a big advantage. You don't need to disrupt 10x, 100x. Doesn't make any sense. When we were getting Alura bigger and bigger, we soon realized that everyone is talking about LTV. You should extend LTV. Doesn't matter, CAC. Since we started bootstrapped as a family business, we were always paying a lot of attention at the CAC. So creating community, podcasts, YouTube, content marketing, instead of relying Google and Meta ads. Although nowadays we do rely on them, but for the first 10 years, it was like a really small fraction of our ad expenses. But when you see the market, you can see that there is no really a huge school in any country for any kind of subjects. So if you want to be a really large company in the education, you really need a multi-focus or multi-product approach. You can see, if you take a look here at the public companies in Brazil, university education, you see they have the K-12, they have the B2C, the B2B, the OPM, the higher ed, the, you know, that's our strategy. We, for expanding the LTV, you need to have different products to different audience. Usually the edtech industry try to create a single product, one size fits all. And education, it's not like this. You have different community and audience and ages and the moments that you are in your career. So the grad and undergrad are key for expansion. And in my opinion, to any sectors, it doesn't matter if it's something really technical as coding or digital marketing or anything else. The university degrees will not lose. For sure, the low-cost universities, they will suffer. That's my opinion. But the main universities, top-notch universities, premium universities, their value proposal will still be there. You know, that's how I see the market.
I think it's the case of the premium universities is fascinating because it's like this self-fulfilling prophecy that no alumni is going to allow it to actually decrease in value just out of the brand and the community that they have. So it's basically, Harvard, those universities, like they have hundreds of years and they continue to be as valuable.
So yeah, it's impressive.
That brand aspect is probably the hardest part to disrupt for a startup or whoever wants to disrupt them. And speaking of the low-cost universities, many of these Brazilian universities also offer online programs. In fact, there's this incredible statistic that I think a lot of people are aware about, that Brazil has huge distance learning penetration. I think just in the news, online signups grew from 20% in 2014 to 60% today. So that's a huge increase in adoption. So I wonder, how would you rate or assess the ability of the incumbents to adapt to this new, let's say, new normal, new context of learning in Brazil?
Yeah, this is really a challenge. Just for you to have some numbers from us, in the university here at FIAP, almost 50% of the students are online only. So there is a trend for sure, and especially in education degrees where like more technical ones, right? Where there are a lot of contents that it's fine to be delivered online, all the ways that we have to engage students and create the groups, they work just fine. But it's challenging. I really think that also that's also a question for us. Hey, are you still investing in the on-campus, on-site learning? Yes, for sure. Because one thing is connected to the other. One experience is connected to the other. If you, Enzo, come to Brazil in São Paulo to take a walk at our campus here at Paulista or Vila Mariana, you will be amazed. So there is a connection among the professors, the campus, the researching, and the students, even if they are not exactly here every single day. So even if we can see this trend going, although this 2023, which is the first year where we don't have the pandemics anymore from the beginning, we can see the on-campus growing even faster than the online one.
Oh, wow.
Because people came back, you know? I want to be outside. I wanna go outside and see my possibilities, right? It is a trend, but just like where we have Alura, which is unregulated, and we also have a mix of 50-50 B2C and B2B customers, licenses, we really see, I'm not sure about the mix, but the instructor-led, the on-site courses are mandatory for us. They are really special, and that's where the big magic happens and where we can learn how to do better in the online one.
To what extent would you say you are competing against other universities, and especially the traditional versus the online models?
Yeah, that's also really hard because universities have a different way in this kind of competition, because they do have different pricing points, different audience, different moments of their lives. So it's complicated. I do compete with some of them, but most of them are not tech only, which is a huge advantage for us, right? So we create a brand authority and community only in tech, and you get better results only in tech when you are studying tech, you know? There is a real advantage in teaching and the professors and so on. There is also the pricing point. So the other ones that we do kind of compete, they are in the big segment in Brazil, which is the lower cost ones. That 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was a really big battle among them, because prices were getting down and down and down, and everyone was trying to be cheaper and cheaper. And now they are struggling to have margins, more quality, and, you know, because they have played the game pretty well, but now it gets to a difficult situation. So Fiapi has the strong brand, strong position, so premium price. This way we can breath and say, hey, look, we can keep quality really high, and we do not need as many students as a traditional low-cost university needs. So we don't want to get and compete directly with them. Otherwise, we don't even know how to play this one, you know? So this massive one is really complicated. So we would rather stay where we are and open more possibilities in different products.
That's fascinating. Would you say most edtechs need to eventually get into the regulated sector degrees to gain mainstream adoption?
I don't think so, but there is a movement. You can see, well, Coursera, there is this relation with accreditation, right? From Coursera, also from Open Classrooms, from Europe, right? And there are a couple of players doing, not exactly, because people think I'm crazy, since we acquired a real university, right? It's one step further, right? But I do not think that people should go this way. Founders should go this way, but they should bundle. They should bundle. They should stop trying to see, hey, I will do only adaptive learning for test score for English exams. This kind of business will always be small. For sure, you can have a lifestyle business like this, but if you are going for a really ecosystem where students can recognize themselves as students, you can do just one simple, small thing, even if it's complex, only one thing from the ecosystem. You can't only test people, give grades, assist them, or doing assessments, or this is just not too small, but I think you're losing the big picture. You want to create belonging, you know? You want to say, Enzo proudly says that, hey, I'm a student at Alura. And Alura is a school. I always try to say that. People say that, Paulo, how is running a company? How is it running a startup? I say, it's not a startup. It's a school. It's not a company. It's a university. It's a different thing. And really it is. It really is. So it's a different thing. There is a different speed, which is not well aligned with traditional VCs. So it's really hard. It's really hard.
Speaking of that, an online school and a university sound like two very different cultures and ways of doing things. I wonder, how do you run the company and how have you merged those cultures?
Yeah. Well, we were lucky enough that Gustavo, the founder there, we really have some close DNA. But for sure, cultures, even if you are brothers, they're different, right? So tackling the culture difference is even harder than I thought. You know, again, better than myself, Enzo, when we are talking about startups to founders, especially early stage founders, we usually say, hey, you should take a look at culture. You should pay attention. You should hire culture alignment. But you only realize that this is really important when you cross the 100 employees barrier. Then you look back and say, hey, look, what is happening here? Why are they doing like this? It's not the way we work, you know? How you try to be in the details in communication and how you do the leadership. It's not a matter of right or wrong, because they will also try to say, hey, we have a really nice culture here at the company. Having a very nice culture is important. But most important is to have one culture. Otherwise, you have many cultures inside your company and you can't control, because you can't tame them. People start creating their own culture, especially in the remote mode of work. People do create, they start working a different way than their colleagues, their mates, because they're not looking at each other with cameras turned down and not talking to them every day in the corridors, in cafeteria and so on. You lose culture. It's not a matter of speed or costs or engagement. I really think that this presential remote is about culture. So when you start getting big and then you acquire a company, then you look back and say, hey, I should have paid more attention about this culture thing. People were saying, hey, look, this is HR thing. It's not as big as they are talking about. Just like CFOs, CHROs and CFOs are more important than we think in the beginning of the companies, you know? And so creating some union here, getting buy-ins from different teams, it's really hard. There is no formula, right?
What were some key things that you did to help you unite those cultures?
We are Endeavor entrepreneurs, and we had one meeting with a mentor from a group here called Eleva. His name is Bruno. And during one meeting, we were explaining to him our idea of a new product that we were creating with the university with different teams. And we were telling him that who would lead this product was someone from Alura. And he stopped us and said, hey, look, don't do this way. Choose someone from FIAP, from the university, that you have already some kind of relationship, and she will lead this new effort because she understands the culture. She knows where she can do something, where she shouldn't talk with. Otherwise, you will be struggling trying to communicate something and you don't know who are, you know, the promoters, the demoters, who are with you, who are just, hey, I don't like this kind of culture. So you should bring the leadership to you and start there. For sure, you should do everything at the same time. But if you need to lead something that's some kind of merge of teams, anything like this, try to focus on someone in the other company. So you show respect, you understand the culture better, and you do things in a more polite way. For sure, there will be struggle, there will be friction, even this way. But that was a key lesson that we've learned.
That's fascinating. That's a great insight. It's basically starting to, I guess, allocate leadership roles in different projects, like trying to intersect them so they become more used to work with each other. And I guess like start building that trust, especially with leadership roles.
Yeah. So this way you just need one line of trust with their leader. Otherwise, bringing your leader, you need to create a lot of trusts. So it's much more difficult. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Makes sense. Yeah, like bringing that leader from the acquired company to lead projects on your company.
Exactly.
Now, I'd love to go back a bit to Alura's history and start talking about like what basically brought you to this size of company that allowed you to acquire a university. Even before acquiring these universities, Alura was already one of the largest online education platforms in Brazil. I guess you guys still faced a lot of competition from, I mean, universities that we were talking previously that had their own online proposals, online programs, as well as startups and corporates, I imagine, launching their own value proposition. So how did Alura grow so big? Like, to what key strategies or decisions do you attribute such growth?
So I will try to give you a few of our inflection points after 10 years running the online business, right? So just, we started as a brick and mortar school almost 20 years ago. And then 10 years ago, we started doing the online. So doing the online was for sure a key inflection point, especially in 2013 here in Brazil, quite differently from the US. No broadband, no smartphones, YouTube, even at home was something, video quality. So it was challenging even for the infrastructure. So being a first mover or maybe one of the first movers in the sector was for sure a big advantage. And in 2015, so we already had a really big reputation and community. So being a community driven
from the offline business.
From the offline business. Again, it shows again how when we say brands, it seems like it's only marketing. It's not marketing. It's authority. It's community, right? So having this authority is really important, right? This article that I've sent you the link.
That we'll add to the notes of the episode.
Yeah, the author says that what would be the 10 universities? University of Google, University of Walmart. What is the reputation? Would you study in University of Google? Google has no authority in education. You know, even Google, who has this kind of magical brands, you will not be convinced from night to day, hey, we have launched at the university. Okay, I'm enrolling all my children there. You won't be doing this. Another big example is like We School. Remember? It's exactly yeah, the same thing, you know? So you need students that are already there in the market so you can see, are they good citizens? Are they good professionals? So having the authority is an inflection point. 2015, we started heavily in the podcast industry. So we launched our own podcasts and we started to participate and sponsor some key podcasts on tech, not tech exactly, on science and nerd geek stuff. And this was like a huge success. So we found out that our audience has a huge intersection because no one is watching YouTube videos about black holes. Just for fun. They are really interested in getting to know how things works, just like hackers and nerds, you know? So instead of doing ads with famous YouTubers that are talking funny things, let's do the science thing, you know? Veritasium, you know, like these channels, US channels that talk about science, but really deep. That was really strong for us because it was at the same time marketing, it was at the same time content, permanent content, right? Different from Facebook that when you stop spending, the ads are gone. Our podcasts and YouTube videos are still there, still sending us leads and talking about us. And Enzo, also one secret sauce was getting into this podcast and participating ourselves there. So we have instructors from Allura being there and teaching something or talking about something in nerd, something geek, something in science. So this is really a co-branded content. It's not only a sponsorship. So tying their reputation, the science YouTuber reputation, with your reputation, this moved the needle very fast.
That's super interesting. And it was not only the founders, but also some employees from Allura.
Yeah.
So these creators or YouTubers, for instance, would create a particular piece of content that included an Allura member in part of the creation process.
Yeah. This is not easy to do, right? Because you need to convince the channel, the YouTuber, especially the big ones or even the small ones. They are not fond of like putting someone else. And so you need first to...
Because it alters their creative process, basically.
Yeah. You need to really understand how this works. Otherwise, they won't be willing to do something. It doesn't matter how much, because they are risking their reputation. So you need to sponsor a few times and then say, hey, look at the comments. people are really liking, and they understood that makes sense, both brands together. So there is an approach here which is not easy. And so this was 2015. Just remember, Spotify was not doing podcasts back then. So really, we were the first mover like into podcasts. It was a wild guess, and it paid off really well. And in 2017 or 16 maybe, we started the B2B, because no one thought that companies would hire online schools to train their employees, the corporate learning, especially here in Brazil. Maybe in the US, this was already a goal for Udacity, Udemy, Coursera. But here in Brazil, it was like no big company would say, hey, okay, let's train our team over there through the internet, you know? So in 2016, we really organized a team. We started, hey, look, let's create a product where they can control the seats and where people are studying, what they should tackle next, their career path, and so on. Now we have almost 5,000 B2B clients. It's half of the business nowadays. And at the same time, the secret here, again, it was what we have done before. So the B2B only exists because the B2C was really strong for 5 years. And then students that studied with us 5 years ago, they started, hey, look, let's hire the school where I've learned Java, I've learned Next.js. So there is this flywheel between B2C, B2B, which is really strong. And I really think it's a mistake when I hear some startups saying that, okay, now we are only doing B2B or we are only doing B2C, especially in education. Because there is really a strong connection here. And although B2C is much harder to sell and keep track and keep the growth, the B2B should take leverage on the B2C.
That's super interesting. And speaking of growth, you've mentioned multiple times, and you also did before, you gave us a teaser of this belief that you have that education businesses can't grow as fast as fintech or software businesses. Because what's best for the business is not necessarily what's best for the student. And I've heard you talk about this before. So I wonder, how has this mindset influenced your decision-making regarding things like product or growth? I wonder if there was any decision where you had to, for example, discard a growth opportunity that could potentially harm the student experience.
Yeah. That's also a good question. Well, AI is one example, right? You can do a lot of things generating with AI. Maybe this can help growth in the short term, but will this be really good for the students? Or it's better to stay the old-fashioned way and create all content, all video, all exercise and everything by hand? So these kind of questions usually will appear. And for sure, when you're a listed company, if you are a listed company, the education business gets much, much harder because you need to present results in a quarter, in 3 months. And no student has results in 3 months. You don't change your career, your life in 3 months. For sure, there are exceptions. But you know, generally speaking, you need 3 years of study and education to get to know, hey, look, looking back right now, I can see that effort 3 years ago, 5 years ago has paid off. So it's really hard to keep this, even for the visiting, the listed companies. It's, you know, capitalism still needs a little bit more alignment, right? There are different, there are a lot of alignment here, a lot of questions, a lot of points here, but some points, the alignment is not that well, especially the pressure for the short-term operation.
My question was like, do you recall any specific moment in which you decide to grow slower, for instance, because that decision could have negatively affected the student experience, the student results?
No, to be honest, the only big things that we avoided was to put pressure on the CAC. Because especially in 2017, 18, where there was a real opportunity of high growth, people started to use a lot of fuel on ads or any kind of marketing direct strategy. This was not only because of student perspective, but we knew that growing with ads, we would get used to that CAC really big. And then getting back to EBITDA positive and cash flow positive would be a challenge. Well, we didn't know, but it was our guess. And it happened, right? Even there are a couple of companies that got investments. And when they try to go for the blitzscaling hypergrowth, now they can't go back. It's not easy to change unit economics when you are addicted to hypergrowth. It's really hard to change your mind and say, hey, look, we don't need this kind of ads anymore. And then when you get your CAC really low, you don't have your brand as strong as you thought. You are really dependent on this strategy.
Why do you think that is? Like, why do you think it's hard to go back?
I think
why do people become addicted to paid marketing?
Yeah, I think because you stop paying attention on your awareness brand and the real mouth to mouth, right? Because when you lower your ad expense, you will lose all these kind of first clicks, first positions in ads, Facebook, and so on. So people will need to recall your brand, right? So yeah. If you are doing this for a long, they don't recall it like it was before. So it's really hard. And for education, it's about recalling brands, because education and again, health, the lead maturity takes a while. No one wakes up one day and say, hey, look, today I will enroll in my MBA, or today I will do an undergrad. Yeah. So let's Google it. No, it doesn't work like this. You need a lot of assistance. You need a lot of content marketing. You need a lot of awareness. So one day, when the day come, they will just type the URL. So you can see that all investors are proud here, because if you take a look on the last click is not good, never, right? So, but if you take a look over there, you see that direct is really high for us in the conversion rates and total absolute conversions. And that's not because we don't spend a lot of money marketing. We do spend, but when they need and they know that they should study, they just go for it. It's not a matter of, it's gone.
It's not direct response marketing like you would. You can get in a product like fintech or SaaS when you get a great offer. You'll enroll exactly in that same moment.
A fintech, right? A SaaS, you do have this kind of, or e-commerce, right? I need a new sneakers, new shoes right now. So you go for the price.
Instant gratification.
Yeah. And then if you get, and there is also this kind of thing, right? When you get a new pair of shoes, if you don't like it, you lost your money, which is bad. But if you enroll in a school or university that you don't like, you will lose 1 year of your life, of your efforts. Like in a hospital, if you go to the wrong doctor, to the wrong hospital, it's not only about money. It's not only about money.
Yeah, especially in Latin America, you might lose an arm or a leg. You were talking about content marketing, podcasts, YouTube, all these things you did. Like, can you share some of your biggest lessons when it comes to doing content marketing, organic marketing?
Okay, I will try to bring you one podcast lesson, which I really think is about my view on marketing for not only for education. So the top one tech podcast in Brazil is ours. It's hipsters.tech. That's the name of the podcast. And I do remember 2015 when I created the name, no one liked it. And people asked me, why not AluraCast? And I was sure, why not? Why not AluraCast? Because AluraCast is not for the top funnel. Who will listen to AluraCast? Only people who already knows about us. I'm not looking. That's not my audience right now. This is already done. They already know us. I don't need a name to get my brand with people who already know myself better, bigger. So you really need to think this community-driven way thinking, it's really about community. It's about creating awareness around your brand, not necessarily for your brand directly. If you try to do directly, you know, you're still building your brand. Why? If you're a McDonald's, creating a McDonald's podcast, that's fine. But even big brands, if you take a look, they do not create podcasts with exactly their brand name. They try to be even bigger than their brands, trying to unify everyone. Because I want students from my competition to listen to my podcast, you know? They are welcome. They are welcome. I bring professors from my competitors to my podcast. That's totally strategy. This is not because I'm a good guy here. It's because this will create something much bigger than Allura. And I need a funnel that's bigger than Allura. Otherwise, I will stay exactly the same size, you know? So this content thing, you must be bigger. You should not only plant seeds on your blog. You should go to the other blogs and be at other podcasts, at other YouTubes. Enzo, that's exactly what I'm doing here with you. You know, mm-hmm. This is content marketing. I'm talking for sure for a different audience, maybe for our VCs for the future. But that's exactly the way that I try to spend.
You are nurturing the leads.
Exactly.
Across the funnel.
No one will enroll right now.
That's fascinating. I had never heard about it, and it makes so much sense, especially I think for businesses where you're targeting all niches, right? It's like if you're launching a podcast with your own brand and you're just focusing on that niche, but what I actually want to do is expand the audience, broaden the funnel. So it makes sense to target that your podcast or YouTube channel or whatever content piece you are creating targets a broader theme than what you are actually focused on.
Exactly. And the naming anecdotes is just one example. For sure, you can have your podcast, your brand, and still be something bigger than your brand. But usually, it shows that you are not thinking the way to create a real community. You're thinking only your brand. And community is not about your brand. Community is something that goes along your brand and maybe also another different brands. So you really need to be at different conference. You need to talk to the other CEOs of your competition. You need to be everywhere. Otherwise, your funnel will be the one that you bring from Instagram and Facebook, which is your last wish. Yeah.
What are the biggest mistakes you've seen other companies do when trying to build community? And by the way, this doesn't apply only to education. I've started to see this more on B2Bs, even B2B SaaS in the US, but also in Latin America as well. So I think this applies to most businesses.
Yeah. So for the B2B, usually they try to create a community focused on the B2B and trying to create these relationships with HR and C-level and so on. So they try to go from the top instead of building trust among people who will really use the tool. You know, when every single analyst is using Slack, your boss can do nothing. Your boss can do nothing. It's not an option anymore. It's a decision taken, right? So for the B2B, I see they try to do this community, which the truth is, it's a sales process. You can't reach your community as a direct sales lead funnel. It's not a lead. Your community, you shouldn't treat your community as leads. Everyone is a lead. It's not like this. It's your community. One day, maybe they will be a lead. And there is a moment for that. So when you try to do this big conference with B2B and having snacks to everyone or cocktails and breakfasts, you should do this for your direct audience, not for the decision makers. For sure, you need to market and have marketing efforts to the decision makers, for sure. And your sales team should go there. But, you know, you should aim to at the people that will use your product, right? Pluralsight that has this head, and nowadays, for sure, they still use something like this, which they even started using the term B2C2B, right? Because they had this it's not free, but like a freemium. So people wanting to learn how to code or some kind of skills, they pay really a small price and they get a lot of things. And when the team realizes that there are a lot of people from the same company using, then they will get to the head position. Because the team is already using, they already know the products. There is engagement. Now it's time to get... So you should engage the community. You should not create a community. Otherwise, you should go to the C-level and try to do a sales proposition.
Direct now, sales, yeah.
This is outbound. So people make... They think that community...
Confused, outbound. Yeah.
It's not that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's the more classic, people call it bottoms up, like the Slack strategy. Focus on the users and then eventually go to the decision maker and try to close the
Again,
the
Enzo, sale. We are trying to be, it's a simple vision here, right? There are a lot of different things going on at the same time. I don't like rules. Hey, never forget, because I think
every it's framework
totally different. Frameworks. Yeah.
When we met a few months ago, I remember you were talking about your efforts to expand beyond Brazil. I think you're in some Spanish-speaking part of Latin America. You're also thinking about Europe. So I wonder, when you're thinking about expanding to a new country, how much of these things replicate? But basically, do you copy and paste from Brazil? And what things do you have to think totally different? Yeah.
So Latin America is something because... We already have deployed, we have some B2B customers there. We are running by ourselves. Doing something in Europe or in Asia or anywhere else, to create a real community, it will take 10 years. So acquiring is an option here. Because even if I can use some of our strategies that we have now, very good perspective about what we should be doing. Starting from scratch, it's totally a challenge here. So acquiring a school, a university, a company that has already a significant reputation and brand, it doesn't matter if it's too big or too small, but they do have people that really connection about my education comes from them. I'm really linked to the professors. That's how we should, our go-to market should be an acquisition, maybe in a specific country, specific language, where there is this kind of reputation and word of mouth that could help us to deploy our own strategies. But starting from, I would say that I'm not going to do this. Well, we never say never, right? But that's not an option right now.
I would like to change a bit gears, talk about trends in education. One of the, I think, more interesting trends that I'm seeing in EdTech is the verticalization of EdTech. In Brazil, there's Afya, which was a huge, big success case in the healthcare education online space. You guys, in a sense, are verticalizing the technology sector. I wonder if you're seeing this trend in Brazil. And in your eyes, how good of a strategy is it? How would you think about its advantages versus disadvantages?
It's curious because Afya had the same investors that we have. So, yeah, our board has a connection. So it's pretty interesting. They have done something in the health space, right? Now they have not only universities, they have clinics and apps for the doctors, for the clinics and so. So they have the ecosystem. So they go even beyond education, which is, it's something like if we're going to HR tech and maybe professional services, which is always an option too. So creating the verticalization, not only in education, but doing everything that a company would need in tech. It's really challenging, but this is an option, a very interesting one. I see like a trend, and to be really honest, I see as... like not the single, but as the most important option that you have if you want to create something with a lot of value, right? Because you can have focus, you can have community, you can have audience, people, you know, because the university that has law school, technology, and medicine, and health, and you know, nursery, and so on, For sure, the top-notch universities have it all. But smaller ones, it's really hard to... Not only quality, okay? It's not only about quality. It's about everything. How you do marketing, how you do operate, the professors, where you should put more effort. So I really see... And there are some universities here trying to spin off some of their segments. So they have everything under their umbrella. They're trying to... Which is really a hard operation... and separate the companies, the university, into different sectors, which I think it's really smart, although it seems like an impossible mission, right?
Legally, it must be very hard.
Yeah, they're in the same building and they two different, you know?
Different colors, yeah. for different areas. That's super interesting. And we spoke previously about the university market, especially about those low-cost universities that you mentioned you feel are in a higher risk of disappearing or are much more challenged by new players. And I feel like that becomes particularly true counting AI when you take into account, like, I think one of the biggest barriers to create a university is that you have a huge upfront cost in terms of content development. You could argue AI reduces drastically this cost, so it would become much cheaper to launch university from scratch, at least from that area. Assuming you don't have a brand authority, which might be the case for a lot of these low-cost universities. So I wonder if in your eyes there's more opportunities to disrupt like private universities building something from scratch.
That's really a tough question because... So the AI for generating content, it's one thing, but you know... When students are enrolled, it's not exactly, there is not enough content, especially written one, right? I don't think this is a game changer. The AI generating content, pure content, with the human in the loop, it makes totally sense. You get leverage here, for sure. But when people say totally automatic doing content, I'm not sure if this is happening in the short term. Especially, and there are also these kind of different ideas like, everyone will learn through conversational AIs. I also do not agree. This does not happen right now with ChatGPT, which has a really... Because people who use ChatGPT more like Wikipedia or Google. They are trying to get information from it. They are not there... Hey, Enzo, get here, sit down, and you will learn chatting with a bot. You don't even want this experience, you know? I want someone teaching me because they know the course. They know the course or things. I don't want to talk to someone and be asking. I need a direction, clear direction going forward. If I have, I will use it as an assistant. That's for sure. So it will get, I think that universities will get better with this kind of tools if they know how to use it and they do not overuse, you know, just like LMS, just like direct messages, just like assessments and Duolingo gamification. If you put too much gamification, too much direct message, it spoils everything, you know? So I think there is opportunity here, but everyone is trying to figure it out what exactly it is. And I don't think we have a winner for now. No, for sure, we don't have any winners. It will be really nice to see how this will unfold, right? Just to add one point here, you remember, Enzo, when internet started, Wikipedia started, Google started, everyone, the schools and university were saying, hey, we are done. We are done here. No one will use the schools and they will be at their homes. No need for professors. And again, we have the same situations. For sure, this disruption is much bigger than others. But I still think that it's not the hype because AI is here. It's different from VR and blockchain, right? But there is an overvalue here.
There's this phrase that we usually overestimate what technology can do in the short term. and underestimate what it can do in the the long term.
Makes sense.
In this context, if I force you to retire tomorrow as the CEO of Alura and turn into an education-only early-stage investor, what would be the things that you'd be looking for in other edtech education companies that would get you excited about their prospective success?
It's, well, I will give you a totally bizarre answer. I would invest in brick-and-mortar K-12 schools or something like that. I think it's more like an anti-fragile thing, right? K-12 schools are going nowhere. They're not disappearing. They're not being disrupted. So I always like it. So people try to put me, oh, you co-founded a startup. And I say, hey, when I started a startup, even this name was not a thing here in Brazil. I'm more a traditional entrepreneur. And a traditional entrepreneur, they really like the red ocean. They are looking at the opportunities and doing something better, a little bit better, that already exists. There isn't, it's not a huge advancement. So I'm here and now I do have a successful company. And why? Because I've been improving things little by little, year by year, and not disrupting everything or creating something that no one never believed it. I'm doing things exactly the other way around. I'm acquiring a university that has bricks and campus and things like this and regulation. So I'm trying to bring a more synchronous thing. More. So my effort here is to keep going the things that we know is really good, really nice. And if we can do a little bit better, it has a huge impact everywhere. I was never someone thinking things totally different. I was thinking a little bit different, things that no one was looking at because they think, hey, this is old. People don't want to create a new school or a new university. Let's try to do a university a little bit better. So that's how I operate. Yeah.
I love that because exactly what you say was usually what pulls the competition out of a market.
Yeah.
Right. Especially the people with different ideas, because it's not going to change. And that's what creates that sort of blue ocean opportunity within a red ocean.
Exactly.
Because
that's exactly.
There's no innovative, creative people looking at those markets. So if you can bring that, then you have a huge advantage against the incumbents. Paolo, this has been a great conversation. I have one last closing question. What's something that's currently emerging that excites you? And it can be anything. An entrepreneur, a leader, a technology, an industry, whatever.
So I think leadership is changing really fast. So how you have this command control among your peers and everyone in the company. So it's about culture, right? So the new generation is bringing something totally different. It doesn't matter if you are their boss. You need really to create a real relationship and show that you can help, you can serve, and you are like a good leader, which is, well, too open. But you know, all this struggle about OpenAI board and CEO leaving, not leaving, and then everyone resigning, not resigning, it shows that it's not a matter of who's the boss, who has the money, who has the pen. So it's funny to see because this is like just one example. This kind of thing, although it's totally with the most important company nowadays in the tech industry, but this happens everywhere. This is struggle of power. You can see that people are complaining about different generations and saying, they are not doing what they are supposed to do because they do not operate like this. The leadership needs to change and to fit. So you really need, and the CEO every single day is more the face of the company. It was not like this before. So the Steve Jobs generation, like the mind of the company is the CEO, and the CEO has the ability to attract and keep the employees. It's not only salary options and mission of the company. It's one man, one woman leadership that makes everyone together. So this leadership topic, which is more a cultural thing, it's really fascinating because it's changing too fast. and how the companies will operate in the next few years, it will be amazing, because the hierarchy, it's not only hierarchy, it's everything, how they collaborate, how they think, how they abandon and say no. People are saying no to projects inside their company. I'm not going to do this. So how you tackle this kind of situation, it's really amazing. How to engage your employees.
It's influence, yeah, more than being a boss.
What is being a boss? What is it, a boss? It's challenging.
Sorry, before wrapping up, I wonder, we've talked a lot about during this conversation, the creator economy, the podcast, in a sense about content creation. I wonder if in this new leadership world that you are describing, entrepreneurs, founders, CEOs that are more public, are more like share more about, let's say, the things that you don't see of a company, have an edge in terms of attracting and retaining talent.
I think it's totally, you have an edge. You have a big advantage when you're a public figure, either you like or not. It doesn't matter, to be honest. For sure, there are really good CEOs in incredible companies. People are not there. But most of them, most of the successful companies, you have leaders or maybe a C-level, maybe not the CEO, but a C-level that has a strong connection with the community, with the audience, with the startup industry, with the employees. Otherwise, it gets really hard. Someone really only in the operations. So the CEO being someone that has this public relations role at the same time that you do your job, which is challenging, it's something that I really see as a big advantage. And that's my role. Yeah.
Totally. And I think it's probably during this last decade that was an option, but it's becoming increasingly an obligation, right? Especially with younger generations who, I mean, like basically the TikTok generations who expect to see their leaders out there, not only in the office, but basically get inspired by them in YouTube, TikTok, whatever. Paolo, this was an amazing conversation. I really appreciate the time you shared with us, and I learned a lot. As I said in the beginning, what you've built is amazing, I think. And a lot of people should take a look at what Alura is doing, because I think there's a lot of lessons that could apply to businesses around the world. So thanks for that, and see you soon.
Thank you. Thank you, Enzo.